Wednesday House Call is presented by Robillard Hearing Centers. Hearingisbelieving.com.
News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Whoa, what a headache.
Maybe if you start treating this like a job instead of some kind of a welfare hospital, you'll shape up.
I'd give you topical medicine, but I don't want to touch you.
Did you hear I finally graduated?
Yeah, and just a shade under a decade, too. All right.
You know, a lot of people go to college for 7 years.
I know. They're called doctors.
Give me a taste of your own medicine, you little fibber. You kids, I didn't bring you on the show to be boring.
He's a ringer. What? You're a con man, a grifter, a ringer. He's an expert potter who signs up for novice classes to impress people. But if he wants to impress people, why join a pottery class? Why not just say, hi, I'm a doctor? Because he's crazy. And fancy jobs don't impress people. I mean, you weren't impressed. I'm a lawyer.
Well, anyone could be a lawyer. You can even represent yourself. You can't do surgery on yourself. It's illegal. You get arrested. And then you get a free lawyer.
Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's time for the Wednesday House Call, and every single phone line is available right now. 521-TALK, 521-8255. Star 580 is a free phone call on Bell Mobility or long distance, toll-free, anywhere in North America. 1-800-580-CFRA. We'd love to hear from you this afternoon. And just while we're waiting for some calls to come in, and call early, folks. We hate to leave people waiting. The worst thing, the worst feeling in the world is when we can't get to your call. So if you call early, we'll be able to get you in. No problem at all. Okay, Barry, I know you don't like talking about this stuff, but I got to bring it up here. Time magazine headline. Oscar Pistorius, possible defense, roid rage. Washington Times, roid rage on trial. A major Indian, out of India, newspaper. Roid rage theory raised on Oscar. Daily Mirror in the UK. Oscar Pistorius probe. Roid rage theory after banned steroids found. Fox News. Did roid rage cause Blade Runner shooting? Is there such a thing as roid rage? People on steroids using anabolic steroids, performance-enhancing drugs, they get angry for no reason, they fly off the handle. Mm-hmm. Uncontrollable rage. What do you think?
I don't put much stock into it.
Really?
Yeah. And there's several reasons. One is a lot of these reports are anecdotal. When you look at the evidence for roid rage in terms of anabolic steroid use, you have to always take into account, first off, if you make that hypothesis that it causes it, you then have to propose a mechanism and also the dosing and how much somebody is taking. There are obviously, you know, varying doses. Rob will affect people in different ways. But when you look at the overall, what you call a systematic review, that is, if you look at all the studies that are done, and you also try to eliminate those studies that were done not too well in terms of their methods, right? A lot of the studies are observational. So there's nothing, meaning that you just look to see what happens or what someone reports or self-reports. You can't see causation. And that's the bottom line to this, is that if that's the defense that they're going to use, there's no evidence to back them up in terms of real hard data. There's a lot of anecdotal data, stories. You'll always find somebody, for example, Rob, right, that can get angry. I mean, just look at people who drive cars or, you know, anybody who can fly off the handle has an anger problem. It doesn't necessarily mean they're using steroids. Yeah. But if they're that type of person that has a short temper and they happen to be using steroids, is it the steroid or is it just their personality where they fly off the handle? So you can't say that the steroids caused that particular behavior.
But when you talk about steroid abuse, I mean, there are certainly a lot of physical changes that happen to people, side effects and whatnot, right?
Because again, depending on the dose.
We're talking about you're injecting yourself with hormones, basically,
With variants of testosterone.
Right, But in terms of the mental effects, whether steroids, if you abuse steroids, that will cause drastic mood swings.
Not necessarily.
You don't?
No. You may have some people where this happens to them, and you may have some that do not. But in terms of the overall body of evidence to say that what you'd have to say with this, Rob, if you make that hypothesis, is to say that for people that use this to this degree and take this particular dose, if they all did that, they would all develop roid rage. That's not what's happening. And so that's the problem. So how do you know which person may or may not have that occur? And secondly, what type of steroid have they used? Because not all steroids are the same.
Right.
You have different types. Right. That, for example, you have one type of steroid that can cause liver damage, anabolic steroid, and another one that will not because of the side chains that are on the molecule. So it would be similar to say exactly that. Everybody that takes steroids will get liver damage. No, only people who take a certain type of steroid may develop that liver problem. So for any psychiatric condition, it may be certain kinds that do it, but the problem is because right. there's so many variants, you don't know which one may
or
may not do it.
So medically speaking, this theory that's being bantied about in all kinds of mainstream media, Time Magazine, yeah, Washington Times.
Pop psychology stuff.
Pop psychology.
Yeah.
The idea that a man could commit a violent act because he may have been abusing steroids is just a giant leap of faith.
Yeah, it's a giant leap of faith.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Good. You want to get that?
No, we'll let it go.
Might be somebody giving birth.
That's okay.
Oh,
it's not someone giving birth. They're not due yet.
Okay.
I'll put that on silent right afterwards.
Okay.
They're not giving birth. They're not. I have nobody due yet, Rob.
It is medical practice. It is medical practice,
yes,
folks.
I know,
remember that.
I know. And okay. I have some that are due, but they're due in May. So April or May. So I'm not worried about that.
Okay. Jerry.
Yes, Dr. Dworkin.
Yes.
We've spoken before. I have MD, MDS.
Yes.
And I have a question that I think I know the answer to. But let me give you a background why I'm going to ask it, and you'll probably laugh at the end. This morning I had a call from the Red Cross, the blood donor people, mm-hmm. Looking for donations. So I explained the question and my problem, and I said, I don't think I can give blood. And we had a long talk. She said, oh, yes, you can, blah, 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 blah. So my question is, doctor, am I right when I say no, I cannot give blood?
So you have RDS, right?
MDS.
Oh, MDS. So you have myelodysplastic syndrome.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, usually they reject people on the basis of viral illnesses, hepatitis, yes. HIV, hepatitis C. You know, active disease that's going on in terms of, you know, infection. So yes. They actually told you there's no problem?
Well, what she said, we'll take a blood sample and we'll find out and we'll tell you from that. And
I don't see, if you have myelodysplastic syndrome, your cells are not going to be, I don't see them accepting it.
No.
Yeah.
The reason I'm asking is because if I could, I feel that since I'm receiving blood, I receive blood monthly now.
Yeah.
And if I could give back, I'd feel good about doing that.
Yeah, but usually people who have the condition you have, they have anemia, they have white blood cell changes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's I don't see them taking that as, I could be wrong, but I just don't see the quality of the blood being donated is not something that someone else can use.
This MDS is a pre-leukemia type condition.
Yeah, it's called myelodysplastic. Okay. Myelo refers to the bone marrow. Dysplastic yeah. means that the cells don't have a normal shape, and syndrome just means it's the type of entity that it is. And so you're not producing your blood cells in a manner that appear normal. So you can have anemias, changes to white blood cell counts. Clotting can be difficult. You can get what's called thrombocytopenia, which again happens in 25% of people. So that's the issue. So I don't see if they're collecting cells to give to somebody else, and say someone has lost blood and they need a transfusion, the red blood cells from someone who has myelodysplastic syndrome are already not able to supply the oxygen right. as well as other blood cells. So I agree with you. I don't know where that information is coming from. I think they're saying, well, we'll check the blood and see what happens. They may take the blood from you and then just reject it afterwards after they do the evaluation.
Let's go on to Kim's call. Kim on line 2, question about eye surgery. Go ahead, Kim.
Hey, gentlemen.
Hi.
Dr. Dworkin.
Yes.
I'm a member of the CNIB. I lost my eyesight in a car accident when I was 7, 45 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm listening. I was reading a book last Friday. In the book, one of the characters had his spine broken or whatever, spinal cord cut.
Okay.
He had partial. He was transferred to a paraplegic or whatever they call it.
Mm-hmm.
Through surgery on his spinal cord, sir. When my left, I'm blind in both eyes. I have 4% eyesight in my left eye, but I've got what I call ghost vision.
Okay.
Is it possible to, I have two metal plates in my forehead. One that covers a wide hole that's about 2 inches wide above my right eye. The other one is, it's covering my, I'd say just above my left eye, just above my left eye to just under my left eyebrow.
Okay.
Is it possible, sir, to have that eye, that's my good eye, is it possible to have that taken out and rewired?
Like have the eye rewired?
Yeah.
No. I mean, that if that was possible, then what would you'd see a lot of the optic nerve that attaches to your retina in the back of the eye is comprised of literally thousands of small cables and each going to a specific cell structure. So it's a very complex connection. And the surgical techniques that will be required to attach all those, especially given the location of where the eye is and the anatomy in and of itself, the optic nerve, you can't pull an optic nerve out to attach an eye to it. So it would be not only technically difficult, but right now it exceeds the capacity of surgical techniques to connect that together. So in as much as you'd like to see that kind of microsurgical technique, it's far beyond the capabilities of the science and technology today.
We'll move along to, is it Suzanne or Susan? Suzanne?
Susan.
Susan, go ahead, ma'am.
Hi, Dr.
Hi.
Hi, Rob. I enjoy your show. My question is, I heard that for healthy adults between 18 and 64, we're going to have a personalized health review now instead of the annual checkup.
Correct.
And I just wanted to know what was not going to sort of be covered and will the blood test portion still be covered?
Well, the idea is that And this is actually an area that I'm very interested in because it requires a change in how we approach treating people who are otherwise healthy. Mm-hmm. And the periodic health exam is what I use in the office as well. So say, for example, you come in and someone comes in and they're 30 years old. Well, for a 30-year-old, there really isn't much that you're going to do because the risk of developing certain diseases by age 30 is extremely small.
Okay.
And what we are doing, what used to be done when you do a full physical exam, is literally a type of screening test. You're having someone who's otherwise healthy, who's not complaining about anything. And that's the important thing, is that the person's coming in without any specific complaints. It's just for a checkup.
Okay.
And so what tends to happen is that you end up finding little things that in the end of the game won't be anything serious. But in the process, you have to do all kinds of tests on someone to prove or disprove whether that is something serious or not, when most of the time it doesn't do anything to you. There was a systematic review done by the Cochrane Collaboration, now it's about 7 weeks ago, where they came out and said that doing annual physical exams on otherwise healthy people causes harm and doesn't help them out. So for blood tests can be, there's thousands of blood tests. So for someone, for example, who comes in as age 40 and they're otherwise healthy, the only blood tests that would be done are cholesterol and blood sugar.
Okay.
That's it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't do other things. But if someone is 30, you don't do those tests because There's no reason to. Again, you have to take family history into account. So if you have someone, for example, who's 30 years old and there's a family history of elevated cholesterols where people had heart attacks at age 35,
right,
then you would do a test because you have evidence of something up. But the periodic examination is to minimize harm to people, to not turn otherwise healthy people into patients, and also follow the specific evidence-based guidelines of what will be shown to be effective in preventing disease outbreaks for various people, given their age. So someone that's 50 years old, for example, there's colonoscopies that you do. Mm-hmm. Pap tests are done after age 21, usually every 3 years if a pap test is normal. It used to be every year.
Right.
No need to do that anymore. It's every 3 years. No blood sugar is done at 40. Mammograms done at 50. So there's very specific things that are done given a person's age. And there's actually a very good app that's available, I believe, for both Android and the iOS for the iPad. And it's if you just do the search AHRQ,
Okay.
You'll get that app. It's a free app, and it encapsulates.
AHRQ.
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 Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, AHRQ EPSS is the whole. Yeah, it's the whole acronym. It's put out by the U.S. Department of Health, and it literally accumulates all the evidence-based data for your exam. You put your age in, gender, whether you smoke or not, whether you're sexually active, and then bang, pops up, gives you the A-quality evidence of what should be done for you at that time and gives you the rationale, the clinical rationale, some background information as well. So you get an idea of what really is necessary and helpful versus what tests aren't helpful at all.
Okay, good luck, Susan. And we'll be back after the news with more of your phone calls. Lots of calls to get to this afternoon on the Wednesday House Call on 580 CFRA.
You hit 40, that's when stuff changes. You don't run for the bus when you're 40. You have a halfway and go, oh, there's other buses. I'm 40, this is garbage. I'm taking a cab to the bus. You get old, man, you'll see you gotta go to the doctor. You don't even go to the doctor, and it's free. You just laugh at the doctor. Not me and you, we go, man, we have to. Your whole body breaks up. Sometimes we go to the doctor, it's not even our guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's another guy filling in for him. I hate that guy. He's got a whole different agenda, doesn't he? I had a sore ankle. He wanted to check my prostate. You know what that is? You're just a kid. You've never even thought of that. Guess where God put it? It's pretty embarrassing, you know?
It always comes down to the prostate with you, doesn't it? Yeah. 340 on 580 CFRA. We're back with Dr. Barry Dworkin. And Andre, you're up next. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. I had recently a diagnostic for an abdomen ultrasound, and I just got a call today with they had found a nodule on the liver, and that they would schedule me for another one in August to see if that how it behaves, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if I should be worried about that or not.
Usually not. Part of the liver tends to have lots of nodules or angiomas or all kinds of little things that show up, sometimes cysts that are in there. And the issue with the liver is that it is very rare to have tumors that start in the liver. The liver tends to have, there are tumors, it's usually from somewhere else in the body. What we're describing right now, especially when you do scans, these things are called what we call incidentalomas. And that's actually a real medical term. And incidentalomas, as the name implies, are results that show up when you do a scan. It could be a CT scan, it could be an ultrasound, that show something that normally would not have caused you any problem had it never been done in your lifetime. You probably would never have known you had it and would never have caused you any harm. But now that the test was done, you are now turned into a patient. And as a result of that, you have to do a test in about 6 months to see if there's any changes. Ideally, what they're looking for is to see if there's any, obviously, change in growth or whether there's any more of them. But usually on the scan, if they're suspicious of a tumor, they usually say that it's going to be a tumor, and they usually would recommend a CT scan to follow up from an ultrasound to evaluate it. If they're saying that they want you to follow up in 6 months' time, it means that they believe that it's very unlikely that this represents a tumor and more is a cyst or even a scar that's in the liver itself. Which is okay. I mean, waiting 6 months is not unreasonable, but I really wouldn't worry about it considering you sound like you're doing all right. Was there any specific issue why it was done, why they did this scan?
Well, I believe my cholesterol was a little high, and I kind of refused to take statin because I have I have CMT also, so mm-hmm. I didn't want to have any muscle degenerating drug.
Right.
So they kind of just did it as a precaution. It's not sky high, but they just wanted to do a precautionary.
And this is why tests like that should not be done, right? Because you're otherwise healthy. You had no specific complaints. Doing an abdominal ultrasound for reasons that didn't involve any pain or any other symptoms. This is exactly the reason why these kind of tests cause a problem, because now it creates concern when there shouldn't have been, and you have to go for another test. And as I said, it turns you into a patient when you're otherwise okay. And it's right. not good to turn people into patients if they don't need to be, because it means you start doing things to people that can cause potential harm over time. And so, unfortunately, now you're stuck in this bind with this test. They'll do it in 6 months. It'll find that there's little change, if any, and then you can go on living your life as you've lived your life and not have to worry about it anymore.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thanks.
You're very welcome, Andre.
Okay, Andre, good luck.
It's a big problem doing tests for nothing. It just... Ugh.
Mike in Ottawa.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
What's the issue, Mike?
We're going away on a holiday, and we're going to be traveling south to some of the islands and on a cruise. And I was wondering, some of the things that you hear about with cruises or trips to southern destinations are things like traveler's diarrhea or norovirus. Is there anything you can do to help, besides washing your hands and things like that, is there anything you can do to avoid that, or perhaps... treat it if you do come down with it?
Well, for viral infections, there isn't much. You've pretty much nailed it with the viral infections, in that it's hand washing, avoiding contact with people who may be sick. Norovirus is quite contagious, and there's no medication for it. If you contract it, you have to wait it out. Some people, if they get very sick, need to have rehydration, so they need intravenous fluids just to prevent themselves from getting dehydrated. But so from a viral standpoint, not much you can do other than normal hygienic approaches. For bacterial infections, the most common ones are usually E. coli, Salmonella is another one. Typhoid can potentially present itself at times, but again, depends where you're going. For some of the bacterial infections that cause traveler's diarrhea, there is an oral vaccine that is available. It's called Dukoral. It's somewhat effective. It's not perfect. It's somewhat effective. And the dosing is taken 2 weeks before you leave, then a week before you leave. It comes in two packets that you mix with water. And then thereafter, you're okay. It covers you for about 3 months. So that's another way to try and prevent, to some extent, some bacterial infections that can lead to diarrhea. The other is sometimes taking an antibiotic with you to take only if you start to develop diarrhea. And if it's bacterial, it may help curtail or reduce some of the symptoms. It won't get rid of it entirely, because the way the diarrhea occurs, the mechanism is that the bacteria produce a toxin that damages the walls of the intestine. It literally binds to the intestine and damages the cells. And so although you kill off the bacteria, the toxin has already been released, and it takes time for the cells in the cell wall of the intestine to heal up, sometimes up to 3 weeks. So you still may have the diarrhea, but what you're preventing is further production of the toxin, so that you have less severe disease. But so those are sort of some of the approaches to try and prevent prevent diarrhea. Unfortunately, it's quite a common occurrence when you travel, no matter how fastidious you are in preventing, contacting people that are sick, staying away from the water supply, having bottled water. I mean, you do all the right things, and still, people are people, and who you come in contact with or surfaces that you touch, you may end up getting infected. But, you do the best you can.
What about taking along something like Imodium or Pepto-Bismol? Are they...
Imodium only slows down the contractions of the intestine, so it slows down the rate at which you have diarrhea. But you can't use Imodium if you're getting cramps as a result of the infection, because then you can actually cause more damage to the intestine. So it does have its place, but it's not going to alter the natural history of the disease. The infection will progress whether the Imodium is being taken or not. And all it does is slow things down, but it won't prevent dehydration. It'll just slow down the transit time through the colon.
You might as well just let it go.
Yeah, up to a point, so to speak.
Okay. And with that, we will move right along.
All right.
Doris in Ottawa. Hello, Doris.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a very serious blood condition. My immune system is destroying my red blood cells.
Okay.
I didn't know anything about this until I had my physical last April and had a blood test, and my doctor got me an appointment as soon as possible with a hematologist at the General. He saw me several times and told me to keep on taking my monthly blood test, which I did. Mm-hmm. In September, he called me and said, "My dear," he said, your count is down to 73.
So you need
and
a transfusion.
Said, I want you on steroids right away.
Mm-hmm.
So he ordered them from my pharmacist.
Yeah.
And he got me on them at 60 mg a day, which I took, and I was on them for 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt wonderful because before that, I was having a terrible time with nausea and couldn't face up much of my food, and I didn't care if I cooked. And I'm a good eater, not a big eater, but I enjoy my food, and I wasn't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But once I got on the steroids, oh, my goodness, I was back to my old self, and my blood went up over a period of time to 143.
Right.
So I was feeling wonderful. But after 2 months, when I saw him, he said, now, you've got to come off steroids. You can't stay on there forever. So he started decreasing the amount down to 40, 30, 20, 10, and 5. My last was 5 on January the 6th.
Okay.
As soon as I stopped the steroids, back comes the old nausea. You don't care whether you eat or not. It's hard to look at food. You just as soon not eat at all. So I know that the steroids can have long-term effects, but, doctor, I'm 84.
Right.
So how long do you think I'm going to live? I see him again next month on the 20th.
You know, you raise an excellent point in that it does become a quality of life issue. So the discussion should be one of what you are prepared to assume in terms of risk from using
That's
the medications.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the fact that it made you feel much better, whether there are other medications that are available to you. So it's a form of hemolytic anemia that they told you about? Is that what they said? Did they give you the actual name of the...
Well, it's a very rare blood disease, very rare.
Okay.
I can't remember the name. It's a very odd name.
Okay.
But there's not very many people with it.
Right. So,
of course, I had to get it.
So again, it is quality of life because if the prednisone was helping you it established your hemoglobin levels to come back to normal...
Yeah.
I mean, that's the discussion you need to have. And then on the basis of that, they either offer other solutions or other medications that can be taken. But, you know, I have no argument with you on this regard. I mean, this is your life and it should be something that, you know, if you're prepared to take that risk and want to enjoy your life as it is, if it shortens your life, I mean, that's part of the equation. But if that's something that you're saying, you know, I'd rather have that happen than suffer for years and not feel well.
Yeah.
That's also a discussion, and that's the discussion between you and your physician, but it's a valid point to be making.
And can you tell me why the immune system gets crazy like that?
You know, if this is as rare a condition as you've mentioned, there are reasons which, you know, mechanisms are not known why this happens.
Yeah.
But we do know that there are lots of diseases that we have, you know, things like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, all kinds of things that people have where their immune systems attack their own bodies.
Yeah.
And no one knows exactly why. If there's a genetic component, if there's an exposure to something in the environment that triggers the genetic aspect of it, certain diseases can trigger it as well. Infections can sometimes lead to that condition. So it's very difficult to know why it happens. All we know at times is to try and stop the immune system from doing it, which is why the prednisone works, because it's an anti-inflammatory and calms things down.
Yeah.
But there are, as I mentioned, other medications that can sometimes do the same thing. But again, not knowing what exact disease entity it is, it's difficult to say what would be available for you.
Because I'd love to be back on. And perhaps, well, he said a month ago or so, perhaps he could put me on a lower dosage to stabilize me.
Sure. You know, you have to discuss those things. But again, if you're clear and say, look, I'm willing to take those risks because I liked how I felt and my life was better.
Yeah.
That has to be considered.
Yeah, I could do everything before, but now I don't feel like doing anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, before that, doctor, for 60 years, I had a very high hemoglobin.
Mm-hmm.
And then to be told all of a sudden that you're low in blood.
Yeah, and then that's the disease that acted on that, and that brought it right down.
Brought it right down. Something did, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I wish you the best.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Yep. That's all the time we have, folks. I'm sorry we couldn't get to everyone. Very busy hour.
Yes.
Thank you for coming in. Good to see you.
Good
you're back
you
on
too.
Sunday?
Hockey game Sunday, so back the following Sunday.
Okay, back a week from Sunday with the Sunday House Call, of course. Health headlines every morning during Madeley in the Morning here on 580 CFRA.